Is character assassination a legitimate and acceptable means of the exercise of political power?
John Tower went on the defense this week. A look at the issues behind the Tower debate this week on Newsmark.
I'm Harold Dow.
The count is five, six, seven.
Athletics and entertainment, those are the only two areas where blacks could ever hope to go as far as their talents could take them. And everything else, there was a ceiling above which you just could not go.
Former Wimbledon tennis champion Arthur Ashe has written a history of the African-American athlete called A Hard Road to Glory. We'll talk about it later in this Newsmark broadcast.
I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News.
I am at the head of the Valley of Grief in the uplands of hell, Garrett replied. He's had that one ready, thought Dargan.
Robertson Davies, reading from his new book, The Lyre of Orpheus. At 74, this Canadian author savors the variety, patterns, and humor he finds in life. This week, Newsmark meets Robertson Davies. Our Newsmark broadcast continues in a moment.
Did you know every year we throw away enough aluminum to rebuild the entire American air fleet four times? Enough office and writing paper to build a 12-foot wall from New York to Los Angeles? And enough iron and steel to rebuild every single car that comes out of Detroit? With over 150 million tons of trash created in America every year, if you're not recycling, you're throwing it all away. For a free booklet on recycling, phone 1-800-CALL-EDF. This message from the Ad Council and EDF, the Environmental Defense Fund.
Newsmark, I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.
I have never been an alcoholic, nor dependent on alcohol. However, to allay any fears or doubts on this matter, I hereby swear and undertake that if confirmed, during the course of my tenure as Secretary of Defense, I will not consume beverage alcohol of any type or form, including wine, beer, or spirits of any kind.
John Tower took the pledge on national television, and the defense of John Tower began.
John Tower is, in my view, the best man for this job.
President Bush stands by his man, but the debate now seems to have split down party lines. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole.
We want to keep it bipartisan. We're trying to restrain a lot of people who want to get out there and start slugging away. We don't want this to be a contest between the chairman of the Armed Services Committee and the President of the United States.
And now John Tower's confirmation is being bitterly debated on the Senate floor.
Senator Tower's decision to provide consulting services on arms control matters just after serving as an arms control negotiator, in the view of the committee, and in my personal view, crossed a line with regard to the revolving door.
Does John Tower appear to be the man for the job, a job in a Pentagon beset by appearance problems? CBS News Washington correspondent Rob Armstrong joins us now to take a look at the Tower debate. Rob, how partisan is this likely to get?
It has already gotten about as partisan as it can get. Everybody's been talking bipartisan and cooperation and all of that. The fact is, this is the first big political battle for George Bush and the first big political battle for the new majority leader in the Senate, George Mitchell. It is apparently splitting right down party lines right now, and it looks as if it's going to end up in the Senate, just as it did in the Senate Armed Services Committee, a party line vote.
And that, of course, would mean that John Tower would fail to be confirmed as Secretary of Defense.
What it appears right now is that the White House is almost ready to concede that they are going to lose on the Tower nomination. But what a lot of Republicans have been saying behind the scenes is that this is going to be a costly fight for the Democrats, and they are going to have long memories on Capitol Hill, and as things go down the road, the Democrats are not going to win a whole lot of easy victories.
And the likely outcome is all the more ironic because John Tower had been chairman of the Armed Services Committee, which rejected him, and a leading member of the Senate for some 24 years.
John Tower, however, when he was in those positions, made a lot of enemies. The problem for John Tower, and it has been all along the way, is there are a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill who like George Bush and who like Dan Quayle and who simply don't like John Tower. A lot of Republicans are doing this for George Bush. A lot of Democrats don't carry that baggage.
What is the issue, apart from partisanship, that is going to carry the day? Is it the drinking question, the womanizing, or Tower's work for defense contractors?
I think it's a combination of the three, Bill. The drinking question is certainly one that's weighed heavily for Sam Nunn. For others, it's the appearance of conflict of interest. The womanizing issue seems to have taken a tertiary role.
And there seems to be some manipulation of the media here and perhaps an effort to make Tower look good by leaking negative FBI reports. I have in mind the Air Force sergeant who apparently told the FBI about an instance at Bergstrom Air Base in Texas in which Tower fondled a woman and appeared to be drunk. Well, it turns out that that didn't happen at all, that the sergeant was unstable, wasn't even assigned to the base at the time. By leaking that, Tower's supporters might be able to benefit from the story being debunked.
Well, as you well know, here in Washington, leaked information is never given just pro bono. It is never just gratis. Everybody has an agenda when they leak a bit of information, and we have to be very careful about how we use it because we are in a position of being able to be taken in.
Now, the debate on the Senate floor will continue into the new week. When do we expect to see a vote?
Possibly Tuesday or Wednesday. I think that the one thing that the Republicans want to do is to have a little bit of time during the weekend, during the first part of the week, to do as much damage to the Democrats as they can.
Now, this is not going to help George Bush politically, I shouldn't think. How will he be able to recover from this defeat?
The White House seems to be wanting it both ways. Marlon Fitzwater said the other day that what he really intends to do is have business as usual once all of this is over, that the bipartisan notion that Mr. Bush talked about in his economic address a couple weeks ago still holds. But as the Republicans on Capitol Hill are saying, there are going to be some long memories after the Tower battle.
And George Bush said that he would not make this a personal showdown between himself and Sam Nunn. I wonder if both men are going to be able to stick to that.
That's one we're going to have to watch. Sam Nunn, as the new chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is in a very delicate position, and there are going to be a lot of defense matters that come up there no matter who is Secretary of Defense, and somehow the White House and Sam Nunn are going to have to work out their differences after the smoke clears from the Tower battle.
And, of course, the big question then will be, who is next? Who will George Bush choose to run the Pentagon?
The White House insists that that's a conversation that hasn't even taken place yet, and virtually nobody around here believes that.
And, of course, whoever it is going to be subject to, I'm sure, a thorough FBI background investigation, which could take some weeks, further confirmation hearings, floor debate. The Pentagon could very well be without a Bush leader for several weeks to come into the spring.
We could be looking at a Pentagon without a Secretary of Defense until April.
And the man now running the place is William Howard Taft, the fourth. We've been talking with Washington correspondent Rob Armstrong. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News. Newsmark continues in a moment.
So, you'd like a job?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. You have an impressive company.
Oh, I see here that you were just married last month.
Yes, sir. You've got the best product on the market.
Marriage can be great.
Yes, sir. It's always been a dream of mine to work here.
And marriage is like business. You've got to work at it.
I'm not afraid of work, sir.
Pay attention to the little things.
A detail kind of guy. That's me.
I've found little surprises are kind of fun.
Gotta keep them on their toes.
I'm especially fond of leaving little notes.
Great for morale.
And I'll let you in on one of my little secrets.
My lips are sealed.
Flowers.
Flowers?
Yes, and walks together.
Now, would that be overtime?
You can never do too much.
Never.
You can never spend enough time.
No, never, never, never.
And don't forget birthdays and anniversaries.
Now, would that include the marketing department?
In marriage, the big things are the little things. From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You do those things and you'll be happy.
I will, sir. When do I start?
I hope you already have.
Oh, thanks, J.B. You won't regret it.
Now, about this job you like, how can I help you?
Newsmark. I'm Harold Dow, CBS News.
Lewis measured him right to the body, a left hook to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is five.
The gun fouls in their way, and Jesse Owens comes out of there with Ralph Metcalf.
For
many years, sports was one of the very few areas in which black Americans could hope to compete. But the struggle of black athletes was not confined to the playing field, as former Wimbledon tennis champion Arthur Ashe points out in his recently published History of the African American Athlete, A Hard Road to Glory.
Black athletes in the first part of this century, along the time that W.E.B. Du Bois came into prominence, had the same sort of difficulties on the athletic field that W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington experienced politically and socially and legally.
Ironically, the early civil rights leaders did not see sports as something to be taken seriously. But it was taken seriously by a people desperately looking for heroes. And in the first decade of the 20th century, no one captured the imagination more than a flamboyant, irreverent heavyweight contender named Jack Johnson. For years, Johnson fought for a shot at the title. He finally got it on July 4th, 1910, in a bout against Jim Jeffries, the great white hope. Johnson won 2 minutes and 25 seconds into the 15th round.
My great thrills was this. Anytime entering the ring that I went over in the corner to put Rossum on my feet, then I felt great.
But Johnson's victory was bittersweet. Race riots erupted around the country, and at least 13 blacks were killed. Within 3 years, Johnson himself had been jailed on trumped-up charges, and it was decades before another black man was given a shot at the heavyweight title.
With hard rights and left to the jaw, he has puffed up Lewis.
That man was Joe Lewis.
Lewis is down, hanging to the rope.
Lewis lost his first match against the Nazi wunderkind, Max Schmeling, the year 1936. 1936 was also the year another black athlete, Jesse Owens, challenged Hitler's theory of racial supremacy.
Metcalf is coming second up on him. It's Owens, Metcalf, and Ozendorf.
Owens captured 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. Sports historian Arthur Ashe.
This was at a time when the U.S. was getting ready to fight a war against another form of ethnic superiority. And so the political overtones and the fact that Jesse Owens had just shattered these world records and Joe Lewis was coming into his own really put the spotlight on those two fellows. And of the two, Jesse Owens was by far the more political.
And in 1936, Owens savored his victory as a political as well as an athletic triumph.
As the people in the stands stood, the Germans gave the Nazi salute. The Americans gave the American salute. And as we three on the pedestal of victory,
Jesse Owens was the fastest. Joe Lewis was the strongest. And, says writer Arthur Ashe, Jackie Robinson, the man who broke the color line in baseball, was by far the bravest.
Jack, when Ricky brought you up, what was your chief ambition? To become a major league ball player, to become the first Negro to play in organized baseball?
Well, I don't think either one of them was that. I think my main ambition was to get along well enough with whoever I was playing with so that they would realize that there wasn't any friction because I was colored and they were white. I mean, we could play together. I think that was my main ambition, was to break
Jackie was incredibly brave. He and Branch Rickey, the president of the old Brooklyn Dodgers, had agreed that reality being what it was, Jackie just had to suffer all the racial insults for a couple of years until he established himself, established that he could play, that he could put the numbers up there, that there were to be no more excuses white baseball administrators could make that blacks couldn't get the job done. And then after the second year, that is after 1948, Branch Rickey, so to speak, took the gloves off.
These three men, Jesse Owens, Jackie Robinson, of course, and Joe Lewis, what impact did they and their achievements have on the civil rights movement?
They were tremendous symbols. Especially Joe Lewis at the time, because he was the first black American who was genuinely loved by almost all of white America as well.
You talk about the Lewis Schmeling fight, of course. A lot of pressure on one black man.
Tremendous pressure, especially in their second match in June of 1938. Probably the most awaited athletic event for black America since Jack Johnson had fought Jim Jeffries in the Great White Hope fight on July 4th, 1910 in Reno, Nevada.
Lewis measures him right to the body, a left hook to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is 5-5.
And in those 2 minutes and 4 seconds, the Brown Bomber gave the entire nation a shot in the arm.
It was a defeat which white people saw as snubbing their noses up at Hitler, and Black saw it as almost complete vindication that if given a chance, we can perform as well as anybody else.
Still, says Ash, despite their triumphs, only a handful of Black athletes in the last two centuries have been able to live out their lives in peace and prosperity. I'm Harold Dow, CBS News. I'll be back with more on the hard road to glory when Newsmark continues in a moment.
Hello, this is William Daniels. There is no artificial substitute for human blood. That essential substance can only come from people. And without a ready supply, today's medical miracles become impossible. But America's emergency supply of blood has become dangerously low, partly because of a misunderstanding about the disease called AIDS. You see, early reports about patients who received blood that carried the AIDS virus have confused some people into thinking that it can be dangerous to give blood. But that simply is not true, never has been. A blood donor never comes into contact with anyone else's blood. So there's absolutely no way that donating blood can infect a person with any disease, and that includes AIDS. The only thing you can get when you donate blood is the warm feeling of knowing that you're helping to save someone's life. This message for health and safety is from the Will Rogers Institute, White Plains, New York.
I'm Harold Dow, CBS News.
Aaron swings and is a long drive out into left field. It's over Pete Rose's head. It is out of here for a home run. Number 714 and Hank...
Like Henry Aaron in 1974, Black athletes in recent years have all but rewritten the record books.
Putting Hank Aaron's name into the record book alongside that of Babe Ruth, here is Aaron.
In baseball, football, basketball, track, Black superstars have broken through barriers that once seemed almost insurmountable. Last year, Doug Williams became the first Black quarterback to lead a Super Bowl team to victory.
You know, I'm Black. I can't do anything about it. If they want to talk about it now, that's fine. But the most important thing is for the Washington Redskins to win the football game.
Blacks are also beginning to make the transition from the playing field to the front office. Earlier this year, Bill White was unanimously selected as president of baseball's National League. Still, for most Blacks, the road to glory has been a hard one. As former Wimbledon tennis champion Arthur Ashe describes in his recently published history of the African-American athlete, Ashe says that was particularly true for those whose careers spanned the turbulent 60s.
The 60s was by far, I believe, the most tumultuous decade for Black American athletes. Even though we associate the 70s with free agency and drug scandals, and bankruptcies and so forth.
The late 60s especially were a time of upheaval, racial unrest in America's cities, massive opposition to the war in Vietnam. And in the middle of it was a brash young heavyweight and convert to Islam named Muhammad Ali.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Muhammad Ali has just refused to be inducted into the United States Armed Forces.
Ali's refusal to be drafted into the Army cost him his title. In fact, boxing officials stripped him of his crown even before Ali was indicted. Eventually, he was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in jail. Ali appealed on religious grounds.
Well, it's all up to Allah. I'm just taking it easy and taking things as they come, that's all.
The Supreme Court eventually vindicated Ali on a technicality. But says writer Arthur Ashe, Muhammad Ali had made his statement.
If he had done nothing else other than be a lightning rod for the Black social revolution in the latter part of the 1960s, he would have more than earned a secure place in not only in American history, but African-American history as well. He looked several million dollars in the face and said no on principle.
An even more dramatic gesture came at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black-gloved fists in defiance during the playing of the national anthem. It was a gesture of protest against what Carlos said was America's history of racism.
I didn't believe in the national anthem, but I stood up anyway because I didn't want no static. But those days are gone. You'd never see me stand up and tell this thing, National Anthem represents me.
Right on.
Right now, it doesn't represent me.
Black athletes in the 60s battled discrimination both on and off the playing field. On the field, says Arthur Ashe, blacks were often underpaid, and they were steered into certain positions. Major League Baseball had few black pitchers, for instance. Professional football, no black quarterbacks. And in the South, in the 60s, says Ashe, college football had few, if any, black players.
I mean, it wasn't until 1970 that Bear Bryant, the old legendary coach at the University of Alabama, realized after a game that his team had against the University of Southern California that, well, I think it's time we better get a few of these black boys here. And of course, when Bear Bryant said that, the rest of the South fell in line. But that was just 1970. That was only 19 years ago.
In the 70s, says Ashe, there were new problems to deal with.
Suddenly, athletes, both black and white, were making more money than they ever thought they'd ever make in their lives. In 1 year, they were making that much money. And with all this money came a recklessness, almost a nihilistic way of living, and it got so many of them into trouble, whites and blacks. Suddenly, drugs became very available. Marital difficulties occurred in a proportion way beyond what the proportion was in American society in general. And the wholesale planned exploitation of the black athlete at white colleges started in earnest in the 1970s because so much money was at stake.
What forms of discrimination are today's black athletes facing?
I think the most serious form of discrimination is one of being allowed to develop a cynicism that I don't have to study in order to do well in life. That is, all I need to do is to perfect my sport, especially in the major team sports of football and basketball. And if I somehow get to college, the rest will be taken care of. And too many of our youngsters grow up with that attitude. And that's reinforced by the fact that they're sort of carried along through high school with inflated grades and not expected to study because they know the scholarship is there anyway.
Arthur Ashe, you've been on that hard road to glory. What's it like?
It's very challenging. It's challenging, and it makes you stick your chest out a little bit further when you overcome those obstacles, and it also makes you look at other obstacles post-athletic life as just something to be overcome the way you overcame those before that.
Former tennis champion Arthur Ashe, the author of A Hard Road to Glory. I'm Harold Dow, CBS News. Newsmark will continue in a moment.
In 1981, one man declared war on the number one killer of teenagers, drinking and driving. Bob Anastas left his job as a high school hockey and football coach to start an organization called SADD, S-A-D-D. Today, because of what one man began, Students Against Driving Drunk is a nationwide force, an army of students several million strong, all responsibly committed to eliminating their number one killer, drinking and driving. Today, it's a fact. The number of teenage deaths related to drinking and driving is dropping across the nation. This public service announcement has been brought to you by SADD, Students Against Driving Drunk. For more information on how you can join the battle against drinking and driving, write to Bob Anastas in care of SADD, Post Office Box 800, Marlboro, Massachusetts, 01752. We're winning the war, but we still need your help.
Newsmark. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News.
Now, I'm going to read to you from my latest novel, The Lyre of Orpheus. And as I'm sure you understand, it's not...
Robertson Davies stands with his striking white beard and actor's voice, reading from his 35th book, The Lyre of Orpheus, at the Manhattan Theater Club in New York City. The room is packed.
Arthur wept. He had not done so since his parents died in a motor accident when he was 14.
Robertson Davies has a habit of writing novels in trilogies, meditations on the rich symbols and patterns that he believes affect everybody's life.
Lives tend to have patterns, you know, and the patterns are conditioned by character. And if you know somebody well, or if you know yourself well, you can see that a lot of things that happen to you are not chance. They are things which spring naturally out of the kind of person that you are. And that is rather freeing and relieving when you understand it, because It gives life a sort of meaning and pattern which otherwise it might not have. A lot of people seem to feel that they drift, that things happen to them by chance. But very rarely does anything happen to anybody by chance. They have prepared it, they've attracted it in some way by something that they are or something they do. And when it comes, it shouldn't surprise them.
And strange patterns do emerge in the lives of Robertson Davies' characters.
One of my books starts off with an incident in which a boy throws a snowball at another boy, and there is a rock concealed in the snowball. It doesn't hit the boy it's thrown at, but it hits a woman, and it affects her whole life. It affects her intellect, and so on and so forth. And the things which happen during the succeeding 60 years to the boy who threw the snowball, and the boy at whom it was thrown, and the child that was born because the woman who was hit by the stone had that child, are all affected by that single act. And I think that this is the way that life is. Every action has its reaction, and you never know where it is going to stop.
One of the most unstoppable elements in Robertson Davies' writing is humor.
I do not use humor. I cannot avoid it. It's not a thing you can turn on and off, like gas or water. It is an element in character, and it is bred in the bone. You cannot escape it. And if you are possessed by it, it enters into your consideration of everything in life that you meet with.
Robertson Davies has been writing for years. He himself is 74 years old. He was born and still lives in Canada, where he has had a multifaceted career. He's been an actor, a critic, a playwright, a journalist, a publisher, as well as a master of Massey's College in Toronto. Now he is happy to be called a novelist. The publication of his novel Fifth Business brought his writing to worldwide attention in 1970.
Long before that, I had been writing plays. I wrote a great many plays, and they were performed in Canada. But they didn't travel very effectively because they were about Canadian concerns, and they weren't of interest either in the United States or in England. And I thought that I wasn't reaching an audience that was large enough to satisfy me, so I began writing novels, and I have done ever since.
But his novels still do concern themselves with the state of the Canadian spirit. A spirit Robertson Davies is fond of taunting. Take, for example, his version of a national Canadian prayer. O God, give me a mediocre life. Do not let me be disturbed by great things.
Well, I said that in order to try to goad some Canadians into protest.
And did it?
No.
It is not important to Davies where a writer comes from, but what he makes out of his material.
A writer must deal in depth with the area which he can observe most closely. And that isn't generally a vast area. People who try to write great panoramic books about the American West or something like that very rarely succeed. It is the person who writes about their town or their village or the group they know who go deep and often write splendid books.
A writer's work is also to know himself, go deep, and learn. And how has Robertson Davies done it?
Oh, constant introspection, reading. I have said, if you read first-class stuff, you don't need to go to a psychoanalyst. There are no insights that psychoanalysis can provide, which great literature will not provide also. If you want an analysis, buy the complete works of Robert Browning and read it through three times, and that'll do the job.
Robertson Davies at 74, a Canadian master of letters. I'm Charles Osgood, CBS News. Newsmark segments for this week were produced by Evelyn Lee and Pam Rauscher. Executive producers for Newsmark are Norman Morris and Richard Stapleton. Newsmark is a presentation of CBS News.